Hello, everyone. Today, on another episode of the Mind Melodies podcast, we have Dr. Brad Zickerman, who is a clinical assistant professor at Stanford University and also works with patients in the recovery clinic at Stanford. Is there anything else you'd like to add about yourself, Dr. Zickerman?
Sure. So I'm board certified in adult psychiatry, child and adolescent psychiatry, as well as addiction psychiatry. My training background is again, I trained as an adult psychiatrist, child and adolescent psychiatrist, addiction psychiatrist. I also have forensic psychiatry training. And I basically turned my interest in child and adolescent psychiatry and addiction psychiatry into this clinic at Stanford, where I treat youth, essentially teenagers, who have what we would call dual diagnoses, meaning they typically would suffer from both a co-occurring mental health disorder as well as potentially a processing disorder, like a behavioral addiction, like a screen addiction, or a substance use addiction.
Okay. So today, the topic of this podcast is going to be just that. It's going to be about substance abuse. So, just for starters, what is the textbook definition of an addiction per se, and how is it diagnosed according to like DSM or just in modern day?
Well, I was actually going to bring that up. So I think we all have our sort of layman's thought about what it means to be addicted to something. But I do, of course, go by a very technical definition of addiction. And in the DSM, there are essentially 11 criteria. And I can go through them briefly. It probably would help. These can include hazardous use, social or interpersonal problems relating to that use, neglecting major roles because of substance use, experiencing withdrawal is a criteria, experiencing tolerance is a criteria. If you find yourself using in larger amounts or essentially longer periods of time than you intended, that's a criteria for an addiction. Repeat attempts to control use or quit without having success. A lot of time spent using essentially is a criteria. There are essentially 11 criteria and that we have in the DSM. And if you essentially have two or three of these criteria, then that means you we would diagnose you with a mild substance use disorder. Four or five, it would be moderate. More than that, then it could be a severe substance use disorder.
So, can you go briefly over why addiction occurs in the first place? What is it about human nature and human psychology that makes people get addicted?
Sure. I mean, there's entire textbooks that are written on why someone becomes addicted, going into the neurobiology of addiction. I think the to try and distill this as best I can, there are genetic components, meaning we know that there are genetic linkages for developing addictions, that families who have problems with alcohol tend to pass that trait down to other family members. And that's likely the case with other substances as well. And if you get into a bit of the neurobiology behind it, I think that the best way I can describe it is that you have several neurotransmitters in your body. And the ones that are most implicated with substances and addictions will be dopamine, GABA, and glutamate. And essentially, substances dysregulate these neurotransmitters to a point where, let's say, GABA and glutamate. Imagine you're on a seesaw and you're completely even with the ground on both sides. These things are in synergy, essentially. If you start to use a substance like alcohol, for instance, chronically, really frequently, perhaps several days a week for years, then all of a sudden those neurotransmitters will be really out of balance. And that develops at least a whole lot of problems with issues with sleep, with, can affect your appetite, leads to problems with feeling, with mood, developing you know, issues with irritability, and then there are all sorts of issues with withdrawal that you can go into. It's all because of the effects that substances have on these neurotransmitters that are in your brain.
Mm-hmm. So can you also discuss a little bit of the social, like social psychology behind addiction and why addiction occurs because of social aspect?
Sure. So it's one thing to have the sort of genetic loading for addiction. It's another thing to perhaps be in an environment where you're going to be more likely to use a substance. For instance, if you're in a household where there's simply just alcohol present in the house, you are going to be more likely growing up as a child and teenager to partake in alcohol use. It's the same thing with cannabis use. If you have a parent who finds it appropriate and okay to use cannabis, then it's more likely that the child of that individual is also going to use it. So there are environmental factors that absolutely play a role. And same thing with school environments, social circles outside of school. If you are simply around a group of friends that are using substances, then it's just going to make you more likely to end up using it yourself.
Right. Okay. So you said you focus specifically now on youth and youth substance abuse.
Correct.
So can you give me an overview of what percentage of teenagers are actually diagnosed with substance abuse disorder?
So the data is a little tricky to interpret right now. The studies that I use look at that. We know that the pandemic really potentially affected a lot of the information that we normally would look at. It actually appears that most substance use has actually gone down during the pandemic with teenagers. That's based off of 2021 data. Now that we're back in school, I think it'll be interesting to track what that what that data looks like again in 2022. Overall, there's, I'd say if you can include alcohol, even tobacco, like nicotine vaping, you're probably looking across the board up to age 17, probably over 50% of individuals have used something at least once.
Use something. Okay. Yes. But aren't like diagnosed with an addiction.
No. As far as having a diagnosis, there's a lot that
that's
goes
really
into
tricky,
it.
Right?
Yeah. There's a lot that goes into it. You have to meet the criteria that we have. And if you also actually look at the DSM criteria, it's not really geared towards youth either. A teenager isn't necessarily employed. There's a lot of criteria that might not just be as relevant. Something like withdrawal and tolerance from substances, for instance, a teenager has a younger and much more physically resilient body and is going to be less likely to experience substance withdrawal than someone who's maybe 50 or 60 and using a substance in maybe the same amount as a teenager. So it is tricky to kind of figure out how many, what percentage of, first of all, what percentage of youth actually have a substance use disorder? And then what percentage of that population is actually finding their way into treatment? You're probably, let's say, 50% of teenagers who actually would meet criteria for a substance use disorder, say maybe 1/5 of those individuals would actually find their way to a clinic and get treatment. It's pretty low.
So that's like the trickier aspect of actually finding these statistics is like what percentage of teenagers are actually willing to come forward if they do think they're diagnosed with this disorder.
Right. Exactly. And just so you know, like one of the main studies I look at called Monitoring the Future, their numbers are drastically different compared to what they normally see as far as youth substance use trends. And one of their thoughts is that as teenagers were schooling remotely, that maybe they didn't feel like they could openly reveal on the measures that they're being asked to fill out. that they could openly and honestly answer those, maybe with parents present in the home.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this kind of debunks the common misconception that people have that, it's too young for someone to become addicted.
With opioids, I mean, I used to see, I don't do this kind of work anymore, but I used to see young babies who were addicted to opioids and other substances. Really? They can literally be addicted to a substance in the womb.
Right. Are there any other common misconceptions of addiction and the portrayal of addiction that you would like to maybe debunk?
Sure. I think there's still this myth that it's a behavioral issue more than anything. And the more that we know and the more that we've researched, this is a biologically based condition. There are actual genetic risk factors that that lead to someone having increased susceptibility to becoming having an issue with alcohol use or opioid use or cannabis use. And I think it's important to try and not have that kind of stigma and understand that these are people that need help and a lot of support. Yeah. And there are going to be setbacks, and there are going to be times when someone who is addicted to a substance, it's going to be really hard to connect with them. But I think it's important to not give up on that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What you mentioned about the stigma being a huge problem, that's what this entire podcast is devoted to. And on my website, I believe there are some resources like hotlines and whatnot, where to seek help if you are looking for a treatment for a disorder such as substance abuse disorder. Speaking of treatment, what are some of the more effective ways that substance abuse disorder has been treated?
So there are behavioral therapies that can work. I'm mostly thinking of treating teenagers with addictions. There are specific therapies that are designed just for youth in mind. One of them, for instance, called ACRA therapy. It's based in CBT principles mostly. CBT therapy works. DBT therapy can certainly work in addressing substance use with teenagers. There are some other sort of offshoot therapies that can help with that. But talk therapy is critical, I think, for any of these substance addictions. And then as far as the actual medication management, there is medication management that absolutely can work for pretty much any substance you can think of. We actually have, there are medications now that can help treat someone's cannabis withdrawal, for instance, and treat cannabis cravings. And most people aren't aware that we actually have things we can use out there like that. There's absolutely medications that can help with alcohol use and opioid use. And then the other important aspect is most of the patients I end up seeing, whether it's teenagers or adults, almost invariably end up also being diagnosed with mental health condition. And it turns out that most of the use is related to some form of self-medication. And they end up being diagnosed with maybe depression or anxiety disorder, maybe PTSD. And then it becomes really critical to also manage the treatment of those conditions as well. And if you properly manage those conditions, then that in and of itself can reduce someone's substance use.
Mm-hmm. How effective are these therapies in practice?
I think they can be very effective. Of course, you need patient buy-in. I'll say, honestly, my experience, the most effective strategy when working with patients, at least just talking to them, is the idea of using motivational interviewing, which is the concept of allowing, I'll describe it as the concept of allowing the patient themselves to develop their own treatment plan and goals. And you're using very careful language to help facilitate the patient in developing those appropriate target goals and strategies to reach those goals. If I sit here and I tell someone, you got to stop using, you got to stop drinking, you got to stop smoking weed. Do you have any idea how much harm you're doing to your body? No one's going to listen to me. It's not effective. Mm-hmm. You know, right. In the 90s, it was this is your brain on drugs, and they show you the egg being cracked in the frying pan. It doesn't work. So we have very well-tested, evidence-based conversational skills that I think are maybe the most important aspect of addiction treatment, in my opinion.
Right. So can you go into a little bit of how this language, like what is the general formula to how to speak to someone correctly? Because I know first when you're speaking to someone with something like an anxiety disorder or major depressive disorder, you use what's known as unconditional positive regard, where you speak to them in a way where it actually motivates them, similar to what you were speaking about. So can you go into this a little more, like the diction used?
Yeah. So motivational interviewing, it's not just for addictions, by the way. There's, for instance, a lot of great evidence that there's great use for it with working with teenagers who have type 1 diabetes, for instance. And it's the idea of getting a patient to affect their own change. And instead of me saying, okay, you should have a goal of stopping your alcohol use by this date, and this is how you're going to do it. Instead of phrasing the conversation like that, it's more, okay, you know, well, first of all, would it be okay? Like, can I have your permission to talk about your alcohol use at this point? Literally asking permission to talk about substance use is a real textbook motivational interviewing strategy. It helps empower the patient that you're talking to. And then going through perceived risk and benefits, asking, okay, like, what is it that's attracting you to your substance use? And then also tying that into, okay, do you ever think about any potential harms of it? Is that something that you think about? And then going into questions like, have you ever thought about any sort of change in what you're doing? And if so, then you work with the patient to try and facilitate that change. And I never want to be the person that comes up with the strategies and how they actually reach those goals. I want the patient themselves to actually come up with the ways that they're going to affect their own change.
Mm-hmm. If I may, can I give you a hypothetical situation where like a difficult patient would, like what a difficult patient might do?
Sure.
So what if it's like a teenager that whose parent forced them into this kind of therapy? How, and they said they don't want to get off of it. What would you like tell this person?
Yeah, I honestly, I'm in a situation like that, I wouldn't press too much. It might even be several visits before I spend any time talking about substance use. And I end up, I really want to get to know the patient that I have more than anything to start as far as, you know, what are their hobbies? What are their interests? Tell me about school. Hey, let's talk about video games for an hour here. You know, you do that and maybe you then get a patient to realize, a teenager to realize, oh, this isn't so bad. I can go back and see this person again. And right. Maybe do that for a few visits and then eventually say, hey, you know, I know that initially this was about substance use. That's why your parents wanted you to come in. Do you think it would be okay if maybe we talk just a little bit about this? And it's absolutely vital and important to explain that, that it's confidential, that I'm not actually able to disclose what you tell me about your substance use unless you want me to.
And then, so build that trust between, between you and a patient.
And then I'd say more often than not, at that point, I get some buy-in from the patient. It doesn't always happen. With addiction, we don't necessarily always have the greatest success rates. That's the nature of addiction, though.
Right. Do you think that for these patients, how would you explain and discuss the recovery rates?
Yeah, I would explain that you have the chance to recover. That if you want to work on this, then I think there's a reasonable chance that, you know, we can have success in getting you off of whatever you're trying to get off of or addressing what you're trying to address here. And I do have, I think, pretty good success if I have a patient who's willing to buy in and they're willing to see a therapist, not just me, but also a therapist, and also allow me to potentially get them on right medications if that's indicated as well.
So before you were talking about certain neurotransmitters like dopamine, GABA, glutamate, can you go more into the science behind addiction and especially tolerance and how that plays into the addiction?
Sure. So, the more that you use a substance, the more that you're building that tolerance, the more those neurotransmitters are getting dysregulated. Like I mentioned, the idea of a seesaw. You have GABA, which is the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter. You have glutamate, which is the primary excitatory neurotransmitter, and they're essentially, in someone who isn't using substances, they're going to be in balance, okay? And if someone's use all of a sudden escalates or using really frequently, maybe daily, then that seesaw is going to look completely out of whack. And where that becomes even more of a problem is they become really dysregulated. Someone then tries to suddenly stop use of a substance. It's probably the easiest way I can try and explain what happens. And of course, there are other neurotransmitters involved as well. Dopamine is responsible for the reward pathway. Serotonin is implicated in some of the drug addictions that I'll see, like MDMA, for instance. But when I tend to think of addictions, I often think of just of the interplay between GABA and glutamate, dopamine, and then of course you have the endocannabinoid receptors involved with cannabis, which is a little bit different as well. But basically, you know, you're really altering your brain chemistry if you're using anything, with some level of frequency.
Right. So what steps can someone with substance abuse disorder do to try to attempt to get past this disorder?
Well, I think the first step in seeking help, oftentimes it's meeting with maybe a primary care doctor. It just depends where you're at. I mean, are we talking about a teenager or an adult? I think finding medical help, therapy help. So discussing this with pediatrician, primary care doctor, who can then maybe refer you to an addiction specialist, finding a therapist in the community. And then if needed, those professionals can then potentially escalate or help to escalate the level of care if needed. If it seems like that outpatient care isn't enough, then we have what we call intensive outpatient care, which are programs that you attend several days a week for maybe 3 or 4 hours a day. Then we have residential level of care where you can have like inpatient detox if you need to be medically detoxed because you've been using certain substances with high frequency, and the withdrawal can be problematic and with some substances potentially lethal if it's not addressed properly. So I think the main thing is trying to just find your way into care. And, you know, there's lots of, I'm sure, helplines out there. There's lots of community-based resources out there. I'd say medical help, working with like a primary care doctor and therapist is usually the first step that I would think of.
Right. What can you do to help someone that you know, like a friend or family friend suffering from substance abuse disorder?
I think the important thing is to try not to give up and be supportive and understand that you're not in control of the situation they are, and you can't just shake someone and make them change. As frustrating it might be to see someone's behavior become really destructive, they're the ones that are in control of the situation. That's the reality of it. And, interventions can sometimes help. But even then, if I see someone in a rehab facility, if they've been to a rehab multiple times, they'll tell me that the first time, you know, there was an intervention, they weren't ready and they weren't wanting to do it on their own. But now, you know what, this was my decision this time, I'm ready now. I hear that story right. So many times. So I think that the main thing is to try not to get frustrated, stay calm. If you're a parent or a loved one of someone who is using a substance to a concerning level, you can try and get some medical advice too, professional advice. You know, talk to your own doctors potentially and see if they have any suggestions. But staying calm, offering support. I think that's just, it's simple advice, and it's honestly the best advice I could probably give.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful advice. What you said about how it's not your fault and you can't do anything to change a person, because many times when something does happen to that person, oftentimes people blame themselves regardless of how much they try to help this person. So I think it's important to shift that it's actually nothing's in your control in this situation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Final question I like to end off on my podcast with is, how do you think we can reduce the stigma surrounding specifically substance abuse disorders?
Well, I think we are making progress. The fact that, you know, the recovery clinic at Stanford, for instance, this didn't even exist 2 years ago. Now it exists. It's a full-fledged operation. I work closely with therapists. We offer therapy for parents of teenagers who have substance use issues. We offer early relapse prevention groups for teenagers with substance use. I think we're making progress. I think the idea of having podcasts like you have, that's great. I think that further helps reduce the stigma. And you know, I think we're also lucky to be in a community out here that I think values mental health.
Right.
You know, I've had the opportunity to practice in other states, locations, and I think that we're probably further ahead in California, especially Northern California, than we are in some other places. And you know, there's a lot of work still to be done. There's a lot of work with lobbying and trying to secure, you know, the funds that are mm-hmm. supposed to be made available, especially to treat youth with addictions. A lot of people don't even know that there are millions and millions of dollars that were earmarked when cannabis was essentially legalized in California to also be used to treat youth with addiction concerns. And I think there's still a lot of money available mm-hmm. to help build programs for those individuals to treat them. So I think we're making mm-hmm. progress. Of course, we still need to make more progress all the time, but I think we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, I have to agree with everything you said. While we are making big strides in the field of mental health, there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Zickerman, for coming on my podcast. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. Yeah, that's all for the podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys for listening. Make sure you check out the link in the description to the Mind Maladies website. See you guys in the next episode.